Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
Hey, everybody. Great one today, finally. My guest is Dr. Abdul El Sayed. Dr. El Sayed is a doctor, which is why I call him Dr. El Sayed. And he's not one of those doctors that overprescribed opioids. I would not have one of them on. No, Dr. El Sayed is an epidemiologist. Why have an epidemiologist, Al? Well, because we're in a pandemic. That's why. And we as a country are not handling it well. And when I say we, I of course mean Donald Trump and his enablers. And by that I mean Vice President Pence, Republicans in the Senate, and Republican governors. My God, these Republican governors, not all of them, Hogan of Maryland, Baker of Massachusetts, DeWine of Ohio, doing a fine job, because there really shouldn't be anything partisan about a pandemic. You follow the science. You listen to epidemiologists because it's an epidemic. But wow, Governor Kemp of Georgia, Ron DeSantis in Florida, Abbott in Texas, Ducey in Arizona. Hey, let's open the state, but not implement any of the CDC guidelines. That's a good idea, isn't it? Kemp, you'll remember, opened tattoo parlors, barbershops, and massage parlors immediately. And then a week later announced that he was opening pickup bars. And wouldn't you know it, just as epidemiologists had warned, if you open up too fast, if you don't follow the guidelines, if you don't even encourage your citizens to wear masks and socially distance, you know what's going to happen? Well, what's happened? So, Dr. Abdul El Sayed will be with me shortly. He points out that other countries around the world have actually followed the science. They shut down like we did, but they ramped up their testing. They did tracking and tracing. And when they did open, they followed strict guidelines. And what do you know? They gained control of the virus and have been able to open up their economies, their schools, and incidentally, have had far, far fewer deaths per capita than the United States. But now we have spikes all over our country, particularly in those states that opened up too fast and too recklessly. And guess what? Our economy is still in the toilet because of this president, because of his inattentiveness, because he didn't want the stock market to go down in February and March, because of his pathological inability to admit mistakes, because he cares not one iota about any other human being and has not one scintilla of remorse about the deaths of over 130,000 Americans. Because he is Donald Trump, the people of the United States have suffered absolutely unnecessary economic devastation and suffered the preventable deaths of tens and tens of thousands of Americans. Talk about American carnage. So we have to get rid of him and his enablers. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, who is currently neck and neck in the polls against Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield. In 2014, during the Ebola outbreak, Joni Ernst said that President Obama had displayed, quote, failed leadership. Two Americans died during the Ebola outbreak, too. So last Sunday, Dana Bash of CNN reminded Ernst of that and asked her on CNN if she believed that Donald Trump has displayed failed leadership. Now, after trying not to answer by bullshitting some word salad, Bash asked her again whether Donald Trump had been guilty of failed leadership, and Ernst said no. Two deaths. The black president displayed failed leadership. 130,000 deaths? No failed leadership. Let's beat her. Do me a favor, my listeners. Give money to her Democratic opponent, Teresa Greenfield, who is running neck and neck with Ernst. Donate to Greenfield's campaign. For that matter, please help all the Democratic challengers to Trump's enablers in the Senate. Some of my favorites, Sarah Gideon, Speaker of the Maine House, who is leading Susan Collins in Maine. Susan Collins voted to confirm Kavanaugh, she said, because he assured her that Roe v. Wade is settled law. Well, her vote essentially sent him to the Supreme Court, the place where federal society judges like Kavanaugh go to unsettle settled law. Let me give you just a recent example. A couple weeks ago, the Supreme Court overturned by a 5-4 vote a Louisiana law that is designed to make it next to impossible for a woman in Louisiana to get an abortion. The law required a doctor who provides abortion have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 minutes of the clinic. Now, that would have left just one doctor in the state of Louisiana to provide the nearly 10,000 women who seek abortions in the state each year. The whole point of the law was to prevent women from getting abortion services in Louisiana. Guess how Kavanaugh voted? To uphold the Louisiana law, of course. But get this. The Louisiana law was almost identical to a Texas law that the Supreme Court struck down in 2016. And guess what? Chief Justice Roberts, who had voted against overturning the Texas law, voted with the majority here to overturn the Louisiana law. Why? Stare decisis. He cited precedent. In other words, this question had been settled. It was settled law. But that didn't matter to Brett Kavanaugh. He believes his job is to unsettle settled law. Give money to Sarah Gideon to defeat Susan Collins, who voted to acquit Donald Trump, not because he hadn't broken the law, but because he learned his lesson. I'm going to be hawking for our Democratic challengers who have a chance to flip seats held by Trump's enablers. Let's beat Tom Tillis in North Carolina, Cory Gardner in Colorado, Steve Daines in Montana, Martha McSally in Arizona, David Perdue in Georgia, Kelly Loeffler in Georgia, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, Cindy Hyde-Smith in Mississippi, the one who joked in the last campaign about lynching. She's in a race. Mike Espy is on her heels. Let's get rid of Lindsey Graham. Back to Ernst. In this interview with Dana Bash, she kind of tried to back away from Trump on Black Lives Matter because, you know, most Americans disagree with Trump on this, and presumably most Iowans, and this is her way, after 4 years of slavishly voting with Trump, she's breaking with him on slavery. That's going to make her whole? After voting to get rid of Obamacare, after voting for that enormous tax cut for those at the top, after voting against witnesses at the impeachment trial, after voting for his acquittal, after not a peep on anything? Give me a friggin' break. You think maybe you're suddenly okay if you say that maybe Trump is going just a little too racist. Now, I don't completely understand what Trump is doing, what he's been doing since Mount Rushmore. I thought he had the racists. I know it's a distraction from the coronavirus and the economy, but is this a winning position? This week, Trump Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, after being pressed several times by reporters, said Trump was neutral on the Confederate flag. Neutral on the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag is about one thing. It represents the Confederacy. And the Confederacy was about one thing. On March 21st, 1861, Alexander Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy, gave what is known as the Cornerstone Speech. In the speech, Stephens laid out the Confederacy's rationale for seceding from the Union. He says that our nation's founders had believed, and I quote Stephens, quote, that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and politically. He continued, those ideas, however, are fundamentally wrong. They rested upon the assumption of the equality of races. That was an error. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. That's what the Confederate flag stands for. The Confederate flag says that the great moral truth is that people of color are not equal to white people. And that slavery, subordination to the superior race is, quote, his natural and normal condition. And Donald Trump is neutral on that. That's a winning strategy. The people of Mississippi disagree with him on the Confederate flag. Look, every racist who voted in 2016 voted for Donald Trump. But not everyone who voted for Trump was racist. Fat, dumb, and racist is no way to go through life, Mr. President. Okay, maybe what he's doing makes some sense. I'm getting the feeling that he's losing support among older racists, especially those in nursing homes. There's no one more racist than me, but I cannot pull the lever for Donald Trump again. Now, don't get me wrong. I firmly believe that in the history of our country, Donald Trump is the most racist president who did not personally own slaves. But I believe that Trump is personally responsible for killing tens of thousands of Americans, a good number of them just as racist or almost as racist as me. So let's talk coronavirus with epidemiologist Abdul El Sayed. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Abdul El Sayed, an epidemiologist who was public health director for the city of Detroit. He's host of his own podcast, America Dissected. He conducts vivisection every week on America. It's very painful, but we learn a lot. But this won't be painful today. Dr. El Sayed is also the author of Healing Politics, a book about an epidemic that he identified before this current pandemic, but one which has only been exacerbated by COVID, and that is the American epidemic of insecurity. And we'll discuss why Americans have grown to feel more and more insecure over the last few decades. Doctor, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on the show and to talk about this very odd, instructive moment.
Yeah, this pandemic has laid bare a lot of our problems, problems that you identified in this book, but also that I think that Americans see even more clearly in terms of the disparities of who is bearing the burden of this, and on and on and on. We'll talk about that. Since you're an epidemiologist, I'd like to get your take on what's happening right now. What is your take on what is happening now in this moment, in this COVID pandemic? We see the spikes in a lot of states, severe spikes. What's your take right now?
We should not have been here. We should have, in every moment of this pandemic, been able to prevent this particular moment, whether it was, you know, having a competent public health force that would have sprung into action well before this, you know, inferno of a pandemic became an inferno and it was still a spark. When, you know, we were in the first throes of this wave in March and April, when we knew we needed to build a contact tracing force and expand our testing capacities and extend our lockdowns to make sure that we had knocked the virus back. This was not an inevitable moment, and none of it was. But here we are. And because of the way that we mistake the conversation about COVID-19 for the actual epidemic curve, it feels like it's a second wave. But the truth of the matter is, we never really got through the first wave. We sort of plateaued and we were slowly declining. And then all of a sudden, right around mid-June, we started to see increases again. The hard part about tracing an epidemic is that you are both looking through a time machine. So what we're seeing in every day's case numbers is actually a reflection of what happened 5 to 7 to 10 days ago because of the time it takes for the virus to develop in your body and cause symptoms and the time it takes for tests to come back. And then also is a exponential dynamic rather than a linear dynamic. And I think our minds are so used to thinking in straight lines that, you know, if you had a little bit today, you're going to have a little bit more tomorrow and a little bit more the next day. But we're talking about exponential dynamics. So a little bit today can mean substantially more tomorrow and even more than that the next day. And so it sort of boggles our ability to really make smart public policy because the dynamics are off and we're looking through a time machine to 7 to 10 days ago. And so you've got explosive dynamics, 7 days behind. And so it's really hard to meet the moment where you are, and you're almost always working too late. When we have had multiple days of consistent growth nationwide, and certainly in some of our most populous states. And so it's really just frustrating to watch. And you know, you think about the people on the back end of this, the people who are dying, the families they leave behind, the livelihoods lost. And it really is staggering. It's devastating.
Your first analysis of the delay, that we didn't have a public health infrastructure, a competent one in place. Also, obviously, we had a president who said this is not a problem for 6 weeks to 2 months, basically. But it's not like everything you talked about was like, well, that's 2020 hindsight. No one would have said that. Mm-hmm. Any epidemiologist like you knew that. I mean, and Fauci knew it. And Fauci, by the way, because you were a public health official, I want to talk to you about that because I find his position fascinating. Mm. And what he chooses to say, what he chooses not to say. For example, they opened up, you know, people went to bars, young people. I met Fauci at a press conference like a week ago. I was young too. I understand that you want to go to a bar, but don't do that. Anyway, so no one's at fault. We're not faulting anyone. Okay, it's not a blame game, but you can spread it if you're asymptomatic. Now, what that means is,
I got to know who Anthony Fauci was a little bit earlier than I think most folks, because you know I'm a public health nerd, and he is a gem of a communicator, and his capacity to walk a tightrope, as you were talking about, between staying always consistent to the science, but also, you know, making sure he doesn't get into a politically precarious position is just, it's immense. It's so impressive.
And it's fascinating to watch. It's just fascinating. I love watching that. So we're seeing the spike in cases. We're also seeing these ICUs filling up in places like Houston and Arizona and all over. So that's very serious. But on the other hand, we're not seeing a spike in deaths. Every death, of course, is horrible. And I hold Donald Trump responsible for tens and tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths. Speaking of American carnage, it's on his hands. But first of all, are the deaths not spiking in the same way that the cases are? I would suspect this for a couple reasons. One, we are doing more testing, so the cases go up. Two, we're treating it. We know how to treat it better. Is that right?
We do. We do know how to treat it better, and I think we are learning from the first most serious waves in the Northeast.
Is that like we're better with ventilators? We know how to do that. Is it this? What's the drug they are giving? I want to say recyclovir or something.
Remdesivir. Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, come on.
Yeah, I mean, same
doctor.
I
played one in a sketch, doctor.
I actually think there are a couple of things that are happening here in the dynamics. And on the one hand, we've gotten faster at testing people with symptoms and testing people who may have been exposed. And so what that means is that we may be identifying people earlier in their natural history, natural course of disease, which means that the lag between the time we know that they're sick and the time they might die, if they die, is bigger. And so it looks right now like we're having a spike without a spike in hospitalizations and deaths. But what we're starting to see is that pickup in hospitalizations in deaths is coming. It's just coming a lot slower because we're ascertaining that people have disease faster. That's called lead time bias in epidemiology. And it makes you think that the disease is not as bad as it really is because you're better at ascertaining it early. But the second thing that's happening is, you're right, our treatment is actually getting better. And that's a good thing. We're just learning a lot more about the disease. I mean, this is a disease, we can't forget, that's only about 7 months old in humanity, right? And so we're starting from scratch on a lot of this. And so we're learning more about the pathophysiology. Like, we had thought that this was a lung disease. It turns out that it's not actually infecting the lungs. It's infecting the blood vessels near the lungs and frankly, everywhere else in the body. And so we're getting better at thinking about how to treat it. We understand that a lot of the death actually comes from an overreaction of our body's immune system. And so thinking about both how to target the virus through drugs like remdesivir, but also thinking about how to knock back our body's sometimes overeager immune response is helping us to treat it. And then the third piece is also that I think there is a differential paying of attention to the news and the warnings. And so you do have a lot of younger folks who are going out and, you know, pretending like quote unquote COVID is over, but their older folk, right, their seniors are being extra cautious. And I think what's happening is that you're getting a younger disease distribution of folks who have a lower probability of passing away in the first place. But it really is only a matter of time because almost every senior I know is bubbled up with somebody who's younger. And so I do worry that, you know, even if as a senior, you're protecting yourself from the most common exposures, you may be exposed to somebody who's younger who may be exposing themselves and then may be a conduit to the disease to you. So I would not be surprised. In fact, I hate to say it, but I predict that the hospitalization and death rate is going to climb over time because, you know, that's what disease does.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're wrong.
Me too.
Let me ask you about tracking and tracing, because to me, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. Did you see the plan that Slavitt, Andy Slavitt, and Scott Gottlieb had put together?
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically to put out like 150,000 people to do the tracking and tracing, go door to door, and find these people, and get them like hotel rooms, and actually would help hotels, but to isolate these people. And it's the only way to do this, isn't it? Isn't that the only way to do this?
I mean, this is the thing, right? Is that the whole goal of quote unquote flattening the curve was to get us to a point where we could then contain all of the cases after that. The way I talk about it is we wanted to move from quote unquote mass social distancing to precision social distancing. And you can't do precision social distancing unless you have the army of contact tracers that we need to be able to do it. And so we did all of this. We shut down our economy. We stayed in our homes. We quarantined and we flattened the curve. And then we had not taken the time or effort to build out the infrastructure we needed to keep that curve on its downward trajectory. And here we are again in a position where the number of cases and the growth of cases has vastly overwhelmed our ability to contact trace, which means that the only plausible solution here, especially in states where you have a runaway transmission, is potentially to go back into the kind of mass social distancing that we just came out of. And if your goal in the first place was to protect the economy, this is like the worst possible thing you could do, right? You know, you think about in electronics, there's the concept of a blackout and a brownout. And a blackout's when like all the electricity just goes out. But a brownout is when it kind of flickers on and off and then burns out your entire electrical system. And we're like browning out the economy because we couldn't get a coherent approach to actually taking on the virus. And here we are again.
You must be watching what the rest of the world is doing. There are other countries have successfully implemented the strategy that we should have implemented, and their economies are getting back on their feet.
That's right. That's right. In every country but Sweden, of course, which everybody was pointing to and saying, see, look at Sweden. They're great.
You can do this.
and what happened with Sweden is that in effect, actually, if you know, they're a small country, about 10 million people, their death rate is one of the highest in the world because they were one of the only countries in the world that just sort of experimented with this idea of quote unquote herd immunity, which is just the worst reinterpretation of a really helpful concept to do a very destructive thing.
We don't even know if this will have herd immunity.
That's right.
Do we?
We don't.
Explain that, because there's so many people go like, well, as soon as we get here, herd immunity, and I'm going like, really? I mean, I don't know if there's no guarantee.
That's right.
That happens. Could you explain that? You're an epidemiologist. I didn't even play one in a sketch. I just played a doctor.
We'll go ahead and give you the epidemiology credentials for having played a doctor. So let's imagine the world was just you and me. We're stuck on an island from which we're going to be saved in at least 2 weeks, but it's just you and me. And both of us are susceptible, but I then get the disease. I go away from you, so I don't pass it on to you. And then I become immune. And you're now still susceptible, but I'm the only person who potentially could have given it to you. And if that's the case, then you're de facto immune, just like me, because there's no other way for you to get it. Herd immunity is that.
That's assuming that you now can't give it to me.
That's right, because I'm immune, right, in that scenario. But here's the problem, right, to answer your question. The reason I would be immune is because my body generated antibodies to this disease. But we assume that those antibodies last for a very long time. But if those antibodies don't last as long as we think they do, if they only last, you know, 3 months, which is possible, then you then become susceptible again because those antibodies just didn't last. So even if you got the disease, which is what we're presuming would create the herd immunity because enough people get the disease that you're now protected because they're thought to be immune, if they don't keep those antibodies on board and they become susceptible again, then that herd immunity fails. And so, you know, right now we just don't know enough about the biology of the body's response to this disease to know for sure that if you've been exposed to the disease and you had it, that in fact your immunity is going to last for a very long time, and that from a public health perspective, we would have that herd immunity because of it. And so this is a very big open question that complicates everything from how we think about dealing with people who've had the disease and what their restrictions might be to, you know, what our approach to a vaccine and rolling out a vaccine in a population could be. So it really is a big question, and you're right to ask it.
Right. And everybody assumed this, and you know what happens when you assume. You make an ass out of Uma Thurman. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Abdul El Sayed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
We're back with Dr. Abdul El Sayed, epidemiologist and author of the book Healing Politics. Before we go to your book, Healing Politics, which is about the epidemic of insecurity, I understand that you're on the Biden task force, their team on healthcare. Is that correct?
I mean, the task force recommendations are about to come out, and so I did serve on the task force.
Oh, it's a product of your work and that of, what, seven other people? Is that what I understand?
That's right. That's right. There were five appointees from the Biden side and three appointees from the Bernie side. And, you know, we had some great co-chairs in Representative Pramila Jayapal and the former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you about that because I know that Bernie Sanders backed you, showed up for you in Michigan when you ran for governor in 18. You know, when I first came to the Senate in 2009, I had done events for Bernie in the 90s when he was in Congress, done fundraisers for him, and I did a big one in Burlington in 2006. So I went up to him on the floor and I said, Bernie, you know what? If you want me to, I'll join you on single payer, but I think we're 58 votes short, so we might have to do something else. And he laughed about as much as you just did. Anyway, so... So I want to ask you about this because I want to ask you about the Bernie's plan on Medicare for all. And the reason I want to ask you this is, I am single payer. Be fine with me. There are lots of developed countries that have single payer, but they all have private insurance, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was very worried during the campaign. We took 40 seats, we flipped them in the House in 18. And part of the reason for that was these are, by definition, at best for us, purple districts, right? They had mm-hmm. been represented by Republicans. And healthcare was the biggest issue by far. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I thought I heard was, don't take away my health insurance. Mm-hmm. Do not take that away. I think the thing that Obama got criticized the most for was, if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. And that wasn't the case because insurance companies every year make different policies. I mean, it was a kind of a silly thing to say. I understood what he meant. But I do think that Americans, a lot of Americans rely on their insurance from their employer and they like it. About 70% of Canadians have some supplemental private insurance. So you understand what I'm saying. What's your response to that?
So I'll respond to a couple of the points. I think number one, you know, in Canada, their single payer system still doesn't cover a lot of the basic things that would be covered in both Bernie and Jayapal's proposals. And so folks have to take on that supplemental insurance because, you know, it's incomplete insurance. And the hope would be that Medicare for All here would be complete, meaning you didn't necessarily have to have it. The second thing in Canada is they don't actually have duplicative insurance. They have supplemental insurance, as you talked about. And even under Bernie's proposal, you can have supplemental insurance. It's just that the proposal is so broad that it doesn't actually include much to supplement. Bernie's plan doesn't abolish all private insurance. It would include some form of private insurance. It's just the duplicative stuff that's the problem. And here's the other point, right? If you pull Medicare for All and you ask folks how they feel about Medicare for All, support's in the 70s, and that's a big deal. But then, you know, a lot of folks would push back and say, well, if you tell people that they're going to lose their private insurance, support dips. But here's the part they don't tell you. If you tell them that they can keep their doctor, which, by the way, under Medicare for All, you fundamentally can, simply because there is no network, in-network or out-of-network. You literally can go see what doctor you want. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. almost all doctors would take it because it would be covering 99.99% of everything that you'd need covered. The support actually goes up beyond what it was in the first place. And the mistake that we've often made when we've proposed health reform is that we've tried to bake in the insurance industry into the system. And the insurance industry, as you and I both know, is entirely about the profits that they can make off of, in effect, gatekeeping around healthcare. And that's where the problems lie. And so when President Obama said, you know, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, the problem was is that he was assuming that the health insurance industry would play on that terrain. And of course, they don't, because for them, they make their money by negotiating sweetheart deals with a certain group of doctors and keeping their costs down so they can keep it as profits. You know, my issue with private health insurance is that I see it as fundamentally a middleman that we've allowed to persist and exist in our healthcare system for no added value except for that a lot of people profit off of it. You know, if we're going to design a healthcare system, as you well know, we ought to do it in a way that's the most efficient and most effective. And the best way to do that is cut out the middleman.
We can talk around this a lot. I just would say that we can regulate insurance companies like they do in France, like they do in Germany, like they do in all these developed countries that have insurance. And there are different ways to do it. And I just did not want to lose those 40 seats in the House. As I said to Bernie, I'm with you, but I think we're, at that point, 58 votes short. Okay, so we've covered that. You say this is being released today, right? The result of the task force. What'd you come up with?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it's not Medicare for All, as much as I wish it
was.
Well,
there were three of you and five of them.
But I do think it goes a long way to meet this moment with COVID-19 and to respond to some of the biggest failures in our healthcare system. You know, one of the biggest wins, I thought, was the commitment to rein in the prescription drug industry. And
oh my God, yes.
empower Medicare to finally negotiate, not just on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries, but on behalf of all of the American people. And that's a big deal. So that's number one. Number two, you know, Joe Biden ran on a public option. And we realized that, you know, the version of the public option that he ran on could be made so much stronger. What we've come up with is that, you know, it will be administered publicly through Medicare, that it will be automatically accessible and enrolled in for folks earning less than 200% of poverty, for low-income folks. In the time of COVID, it can't just be a gold plan. It has to be a platinum plan, meaning it covers 90% of the healthcare costs that somebody might incur. That it ought to be the kind of plan that folks can rely upon and know they have access to, even if they have employer-sponsored health insurance, so they ought to be able to take it up if and when they need it. And then a couple of other points that we're really excited about include an executive order, a commitment for an executive order on health equity, to engage all of government in taking this on, eliminating some of the big barriers that immigrants have to getting healthcare in our country, whether it's the quote-unquote public charge rule or this five-year ban on getting services that people can have after they've immigrated, and being able to invest in doubling the federally qualified health centers and funding for them in our country to take on the severe lack in rural healthcare. And one that I'm particularly proud of and feel is critical. I ran for governor on a single payer health plan in Michigan, and there was a provision in the ACA called the 1332 waiver that would have subsidized those kinds of state-based universal insurance programs. And Biden's recommendations make a commitment to that program. So I think there's a lot there and a lot further to go.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. This is, it's such a complex issue, and that's part of the Medicare for All. One of the advantages of it is that it simplifies everything. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about pharma, my goodness, because I remember Bernie would go like, the health care industry makes, $100 billion a year in profits. Most of that was pharma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and we mm-hmm. and the rest of the world pays like 30 to 40 cents on the same drugs we pay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a solution to this. Have you heard my solution to this?
What was that?
There's only two countries in the world that allow these pharmaceutical companies to advertise on television and to deduct, mm-hmm. take a tax deduction for it. And, okay, if they're going to do that, I think we should regulate it in a way. And you know, in those commercials, like the last half of it is always the negative side effects that you can have.
Yep. Speaking at like a million miles a minute.
Yeah, they go fast and they have beautiful music that's very comforting. And then they have the actors in the commercial, you know, they're riding, it's a couple riding bike around a lake. They're listening to light jazz in a gazebo. That's a grandfather having a three-legged race with his granddaughter. It's a couple antiquing. Instead of that stuff, instead of the actors doing that, why don't we require them to act out the side effects? So it'd be like, taking Ubetrix may cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and other kinds of lymphoma. Let's see.
You know, I'm just imagining how this might go.
I think you end with just imagine, you know, when they have the woman with her daughter doing Tai Chi in the park, if she has like projectile diarrhea, the girl. People are not going to buy the Ubetrix. They're just not going to buy it, you see. And so this is, to me, a brilliant way of getting the cost down on pharmaceuticals, because they just charge an arm and a leg for those that they advertise on TV, right?
That's right. I'll tell you, one of the recommendations from the task force was to stop subsidizing those commercials as business costs.
Good for you. Good for you. Good for the task force. But is it too late to get this in?
You know, I'm going to call them and let them know that we need to like rush this last one in. I think it would go so much further in terms of really forcing people to have that conversation with their doctor.
Stop taking Ubetrix if your tongue swells to three times its normal size. There's all kinds of stuff to talk about when we're talking about healthcare reform, and we've done enough. But, you know, certainly hospitals, and you write about it in your damn book. That's a good transition to your damn book, okay? The basic thesis of the book is that you're an epidemiologist and there's an epidemic of insecurity. Americans are feeling more and more insecure in so many different ways and have been for quite a while. Part of it is healthcare, but you really, you know, go down a long list of reasons that Americans, even you write about people who are making a lot of money or feel insecure. Give me a wrap on that.
You know, I ran for office statewide. You have the experience of doing this too. And you start with this conventional wisdom that people in different parts of a state who work different jobs and experience the world differently as a function of who they are, that their complaints are going to be different. I started to campaign and, you know, I thought that I was trading my epidemiologist hat for a candidate hat. But, you know, as I'd come home from different parts of the state, whether it was a place like Flint or Detroit or a place like the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, I couldn't help but recognize the patterns in what people were asking about, why it is that their kid's school looks exactly like it did 30 years ago when they went there, why it is that, you know, in a state that's defined by its fresh water, people still can't afford basic water and water poison 9,000 kids in a place like Flint. Why they have to worry about getting sick if, in fact, they have insurance because they worry about the debt that might follow them. Why they can't find high-quality jobs in their communities anymore. And those jobs, if they exist, have been turned into gigs with lower pay and fewer benefits. And so these challenges, it didn't matter if you're talking to poor or working or retired Black folk in places like Detroit or poor or working or retired white folk in places like Kalkaska, they were the same questions. And so as I thought about this moment in our politics, the election of Donald Trump, the failure of state and local government in Michigan across the board, whether it was Flint or the shutdown of the health department that I had just rebuilt in Detroit, I realized that there was something broader here. And that's the fact that all of the systems that we've relied upon to deliver the basic means of a dignified life in our communities, that these systems, healthcare or housing or education or infrastructure or voting itself or the entire economy, that they've all sort of been captured by the profit motive of a small few number of operators to the exclusion of the rest of us. That epidemic, right, that I talk about in the book is the subjective experience of that, the anxiety and the fear that it brings up, and the way that that sets us up to be demagogued and divided by people who tell us that the reason that these systems are failing us is because other people have taken, rather than the fact that these systems have been dominated by the very folks who benefit most from those systems. And so I wanted to break that down and introduce this idea and also introduce a way of talking about it as an epidemic.
Well, what's interesting about this to me, reading your book, is that this is wide-ranging. I mean, you go through so many aspects of the way life works now that makes people feel insecure, whether it is the cost of college, whether it's health care, there is the disease of despair. You go on and on. There's mental illness. And that has been exacerbated by, obviously, everybody having a shelter in place. So there's just a litany of these. And my feeling is that I think that people reading this will absolutely agree with every point you make, and that these are things that the next president, the Joe Biden, I hope he wins, mm-hmm. he has to win, that he has to address. And last week, that Sean Hannity asked President Trump what his goals were for the next term, and he had nothing. And, you know, Biden, he's been along with us, been spending a lot of time at home, and he hasn't been out there. He hasn't been doing rallies like somebody irresponsibly. And Trump has been digging himself a hole. And when your opponent's digging himself a hole, you let him dig. But Biden is going to have to answer the question that Hannity asked. And the good news is that the answers to those questions, I believe all Americans support us on. Not all, but a large majority. You talk about broadband. Obviously, we need universal broadband. There are a lot of kids who don't have access to broadband. And that is part of the dysfunction that has been revealed by this pandemic. The racial disparities in who's dying during this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the point that you're making, because I think if we want to win, and we have to win, because, you know, nothing short of democracy is on the line, we can't just allow the contrast between Donald Trump and anyone running against Donald Trump to carry the day, because unfortunately that's the mistake that we made in 2016. We have answers and we have solutions, and that more than anything else is what the American people are looking for, right? We're in the middle of a global pandemic. We're having a reckoning about our country's painful and broken history when it comes to race and racism. And we need to be able to full-throatedly embrace the fact that we do have solutions and we can see them enacted if we win. And, you know, the point that you made about racial disparities in health, COVID-19 has shown a light on the way that this epidemic of insecurity shapes access to health and healthcare in some pretty profound ways. But it's not just COVID, right? A lot of folks are like, oh, well, the disparities are really big when it comes to COVID-19. They don't realize that it's actually really big when it comes to any cause of death, heart disease, diabetes, strokes, cancers, infant mortality, right? All of them are diseases where Black Americans and Latinx folks and Native Americans suffer 2 to 3 times the rates of death. And that is not about pathology that happens under the skin, right? It's not about the ways that cells get processed and viruses enter those cells, et cetera. No, it is about pathology that happens above the skin. And those are the kinds of pathologies that we need to be proposing solutions to, and I believe will win us votes, not just you know, relying on the other guy losing his votes.
I think people are seeing it. I do think the pandemic has laid this stuff bare for people to see. Obviously, the murder of George Floyd, my hometown, has, I think, opened people's eyes. What Trump is doing now, what he did at Mount Rushmore, what he did on the 4th of July, I don't understand his strategy there. I thought he had all the racists. Evidently not. I have this theory that maybe older racists, he's losing their support.
I mean, I'll tell you this, right? You know, at some point, you can hold on to your ideology for so long, but you know, when you have a president who is actively denying a disease that's killed 130,000 Americans, it becomes really hard to support him no matter what. And you know, he's trying to foment a culture war against the realities of the fact that people's friends and neighbors and loved ones have been dying for months, and his government is doing nothing about it. He's losing, folks. That's a good thing because I think it speaks to something good in us all. I do think that in this moment, we do focus a lot on this notion of people being irredeemable. And I actually think that we have to step in and say, look, even if you supported Donald Trump in 2016, it doesn't make you a racist. It doesn't make you irredeemable. And even if you do have some racist ideas, right, we can come together to address them and move beyond them. And you don't have to be a racist forever just because you've done or said a racist thing. And I think that that focus on the future and empowering people beyond the worst in themselves by embracing the best in them has to be part of what we do. And I think focusing in on those solutions to problems that we're all facing can be a way to try and get to some of that deeper healing. You know, we've got to start treating racism not as a function of who someone is, but rather as a disease that they're suffering from. And we need to excise that disease to rehabilitate and empower them. And I think that that's something that we've sort of been missing in our political culture for some time.
I really do believe that post, and it wasn't just the murder of George Floyd, although it was so obscene that I think it sparked what we saw. But I think it was a rash of these of late. And I think that people actually, I mean, you see it in the polling. A large majority now of Americans are saying, yep, we have systemic racism. I think there's been a change. And I agree with you. There are people who have implicit bias that they're not aware of, and I think that they're beginning to deal with it. And I think that's a really good thing. And I don't know what the president is thinking here, but God bless him for just, I think he's shooting himself in the foot. But like defending the Confederate flag, he disagrees with the people of Mississippi on that.
Yeah.
That's not a winner. That's nope. Not a winner right now. And it shouldn't be.
If your campaign is about protecting the legacy of dead people who were traitors to your country, and that's the campaign that you're going to run for president of the United States in 2020, goodbye.
They're going to do everything they can to suppress votes. The way things are going and the way Trump is treating this, this is going to be around in November. Mm-hmm. And people are not going to want to go to the polls, and they're going to prevent people from voting by mail. And two, what you said, that democracy is at stake. And three, if it's close, he won't leave. So Biden has to win by a lot. You know, you talk about infrastructure. You just talk about that. Americans want us, you know, to have infrastructure. They want us to have railroads and airports and roads and bridges that just even resemble the other developed countries. They want a competent government again. They don't want a government that's filled with just, you know, with cronies and crooks.
Yeah. We have a lot of healing to do as a country. And one of the things that I grew up in a household that was really quite odd, even by American standards, so far as my father.
Yes, you cover that in the book, and it's very odd. Go ahead.
It is. My father is an immigrant from Egypt, as is my mother, but I was raised by my stepmother, who is a daughter of the American Revolution. And I spent a lot of my summers in Egypt, where I got to see my country from afar. I got to think about what it means to be an American outside of America. And that's not something that a lot of folks who grow up here get to do. And so, you know, I think about what it means to see somebody for how they see themselves and where they see themselves and be able to empathize with the highest and best in them. And I think we have an opportunity coming out of this election not to ignore the past, not to pretend like it didn't exist, not to sweep a lot of the worst in what the Trump era has created under the rug, but to see the best in people and help them overcome the worst of that last moment to be their best. And I do hope that that empathy and that belief in our future can guide us, because I worry a lot about what might happen if this, you know, resentment, us versus them politics continues to divide us. And, you know, make no mistake, it's not like even if we beat Donald Trump, that Trumpism is gone, or that even Donald Trump is gone. It's just that, you know, they no longer have the platform that they've had. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we pull out what's best in people to defeat Trumpism, not just defeat Donald Trump?
I hope that happens.
Me too.
I know what I want to talk to you about. Flint. What's going on in Flint? I mean, you're the director of public health in Detroit. Detroit's on Flint, but you're director of public health in Michigan. Michigan, by the way, is surrounded by fresh water, as you point out. It's got you got your Lake Michigan, you got your Lake Superior, you got your Lake Huron, and your Lake Erie. Mm-hmm. Which, what percentage of the Earth's fresh water surrounds Michigan?
It's like 21%.
Okay, so you're a state that is surrounded by 21% of the fresh water on Earth. What's going on with the water in Flint now?
We still have not completed the full Jesus. Replacement of the piping in Flint.
Jesus.
And what that means is that people still don't trust their water. Now, the state will say that testing has shown that lead levels in the water are within normal limits, which then forces a bigger question about, like, why are there
what's
limits
normal?
In water? Yeah, then there's lead is not normally in water. There is no normal limit of lead in water, right? Normal is zero. And you can imagine, right, the people in Flint have heard that before. So do they trust it? No.
So when they say it's down to acceptable levels, what level is that? Is that a level that I have my water? Is that a level that most Americans have in their water? What is that?
So we do know that, unfortunately, because we've assented to these ideas that there is some quote-unquote normal level of lead in water, that a lot of Americans, unbeknownst to them, have lead in their water, particularly in urban America, where a lot of these buildings were built in a time when we thought lead was a perfectly acceptable thing to be building pipes out of. And what we also know is that even the smallest amount of lead in water or in paint chips, which is in the more common place where kids are exposed to lead, can have devastating impacts on childhood development. And so what we really need as a country is a commitment to taking lead out of literally everything. And a lot of folks will, as always, say, well, it's too expensive to do. And my question is, well, you know, if protecting our kids' brains isn't our number one priority, then what is? Like, well, what else is there that you ought to be investing in if it's not protecting small brains from a poisonous chemical that people put there in the first place and can be removed?
You know, the number one capital, the most important capital we should have as a country is our children's brains.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about capital, I mean, you know, is a kid getting lead his bloodstream and hurting his brain development, would that kid otherwise have figured out how to suck the CO2 out of the air?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
what an unbelievable stupid. Now, this is where I think Biden, I mean, when you talk about infrastructure, pipes, water pipes. My goodness. I mean, that we haven't done that, that's crazy. And this president, that is as far from his radar as anything is the, you know, the pipes in Flint.
You could care less. I mean, and it's clear he could care less.
He couldn't care less.
You're right. He could not care less.
Yeah.
You know what it is, Sheesh. Right? Is that my public school should have been better. Or maybe like everybody says, I should just learn English.
This was great. I really enjoyed this.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.